Baseball, America's game. Baffling to outsiders, baffling to most Americans too. Kind of like cricket, except not quite as long and boring. A sport that seems to naturally encourage larger-than-life personalities. But nobody, perhaps in any sport, has ever been larger than one early baseball player named Rube Waddell. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities.
You got a diamond, you got nine men, you got a hat and a bat, and that's not all. You got the bleachers, got them from spring till fall. You got a dog and a drink and an umpire's call. What do you want? Let's play ball.
As you can see, I'm switching up the intro a little bit. I hope you liked it. Anyway, Rube Waddell. If you look up this man's name, Google's list of frequently asked questions about him, right below his Wikipedia page, includes the questions, how did Rube Waddell get his nickname? Did Rube Waddell have children? Where is Waddell buried? And was Rube Waddell real? Which should give you a hint of what we're getting into. Rube Waddell was the closest thing there is to a real-life Forrest Gump. George Edward Waddell was born outside of Bradford, Pennsylvania on Friday the 13th of October 1876. According to the Baseball Hall of Fame's website, he acquired the lifelong nickname Rube to answer apparently one of the other common questions about him, quote, because he was a big, fresh kid, end quote. Whatever that means. Another source says it was because he was big and clumsy. I mean, he definitely wasn't clumsy, as you'll see, but I can see how he had clumsy vibes. Growing up, hardly ever attending school, young Rube was, in the words of sports historian Alan Levy, a decidedly different sort of child. While his four siblings were at school or helping out their parents on the farm, Rube could be found fishing by snatching trout right out of the river with his bare hands, or training his throwing arm by knocking birds out of the sky with rocks. Several times throughout his early childhood, toddler Rube Waddell waddled off, sometimes being missing for days at a time. That was a different century for sure, until his parents invariably found him at the Bradford Fire Station. Which shouldn't be a huge surprise. What sex is to you and I, fire engines are to toddlers, right? Except that Rube never outgrew his fascination with firefighters and their machines. In fact, firefighting may have been his second love in life, behind only baseball. When Rube was a teenager, the Waddell family moved to Butler, Pennsylvania, a larger town in the same area, where Rube's dad, a bit disturbed by his son's eccentricities, suggested Rube should put his strong, bird-killing arm to work pitching baseball. Rube took warmly to the idea, but he had a hard time finding other kids to play ball with, not just because he was weird, but because it turned out he was just such a damn good pitcher. He threw so hard, it stung other kids' hands. Serious team managers began to take note of the kid's talent, and in 1895, when Rube was 19, he was signed by the local minor league team in Butler. Rube seemed not to understand that this was serious business. Despite his physical talent, he didn't really get the rules, repeatedly attempting to hit the batter with his ball in the mistaken belief this would get the batter out. Friends would sometimes stop by during his games with fishing rods, planning to go fishing afterward, which would cause Rube to immediately run off the field mid-game to go fishing with them. Supporters of rival teams began to cotton on to this, discovering that Rube couldn't actually recognize his friends, and anyone sitting with a fishing rod in the stands would cause Rube to run over, with the full expectation that he was being invited mid-game to go fishing. And Rube had his priorities straight, too. While he was aware that by this point he was a bit of a local celebrity, a really good baseball player when he could be convinced to play ball, he still believed that the main path in his life was firefighting, and baseball was just a distraction. He wasn't even employed as a firefighter. Like everything else in life, he took the title of volunteer firefighter to its logical extreme. He would wear a self-designed red firefighter suit under his baseball jersey in case any fires broke out during a game, and if he saw a fire engine go by, which at that point consisted of steam-propelled water pumps drawn by horses, he would strip off his jersey and run off chasing the firefighters in the hope of participating in putting out the fire. He never did successfully put out a fire, at least not at this stage in his life, but he couldn't be stopped from chasing fire engines. When the manager of Butler's team banned him from wearing his firefighter suit under his outfit, he took to mean that he couldn't wear anything under his baseball jersey at all, because what else could he possibly wear if he's not wearing the firefighter suit? And took to wearing absolutely nothing under his baseball jersey. Not even this stopped him from stripping off his jersey and running after fire engines whenever he heard one. I'm pretty sure that after this, Butler's fire chief and Butler's minor league baseball manager had a frank heart-to-heart about what to do with Rube Waddell. But Rube did have talent. Talent greater than anyone in this rural belt of Pennsylvania small towns had ever seen. And after a while, he stopped trying to make up his own violent rules, making him a much more attractive hire for bigger teams. A larger league of Western Pennsylvania baseball teams, financed by the deep pockets of the local iron and oil companies, decided to sign Rube Waddell. Rube's tenure with the Iron and Oil League proved to be short-lived. His playing got good press, including from newspapers in Pittsburgh, the first time Rube got attention in a big city. But like everything else about Rube Waddell, his attendance at his own games was erratic, and he didn't get along with his teammates, most of whom weren't particularly great players. His team, Franklin, soon fell to the bottom of the Iron and Oil League's rankings, and attendance at their games collapsed. Whenever Franklin did score any points, it was pretty much exclusively because of Rube and his strong bird-killing arms, and not a lot of Pennsylvanians at the turn of the 19th century were interested in watching a baseball team consisting of a bunch of random schmucks who didn't know what they were doing, and one guy who definitely didn't know what he was doing, but was doing it really well, but would much rather be chasing naked after fire engines. Franklin was cut from the Iron and Oil League at the end of the season, and Rube returned to his family farm in Butler, dejected, coping with his grief at the apparent end of his baseball career by drinking, which became perhaps the most acute consequence of Rube's lifelong poor judgment. In 1897, Rube got another chance, but only briefly. The manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, a man named Connie Mack, who presumably would rather go by a girl's name than his real name, which was Cornelius McGillicuddy, decided to see him try out. Rube initially turned down this offer, and was only persuaded to go to Pittsburgh with the promise of a free breakfast. Over that breakfast, he said something to Connie Mack that is not recorded in the annals of history, but caused Mack to send Rube right back to Butler, then and there, without ever seeing him play. Just a few months later, though, Rube got a very strange offer, which was almost as strange then as it would be now. Volant College, a small private school near Butler, offered him a scholarship to play on the school's baseball team, even though Rube had no education, had no intention of going to college, and wouldn't even be required to attend any classes at Volant. This episode of his life was crazy even by Rube Waddell standards, and I'm not totally convinced it wasn't an Arthur-style dream sequence cooked up by some baseball historian somewhere, sleeping fitfully after reading through Waddell's Wikipedia page. Here we go. Rube Waddell was surprisingly enthusiastic about playing for Volant and attended every game he was supposed to play in. During games, he would often walk on his hands, turn cartwheels, and bear crawl across the field. He averaged 15 strikeouts per game. To put that into context, the average number of strikeouts per MLB game recently reached 8.5, and sports blogs are currently freaking out about how high that is. Rube got paid, despite being a college athlete, $1 per game. And after each game, he would immediately go and spend it all at the local soda fountain, where a glass of soda cost a nickel. He didn't attend any classes at Volant, but he did play in the school band as the drum major. In the middle of the season, two nearby colleges, upon learning that their baseball teams were scheduled to play Volant, informed Volant's management that suddenly their schedules were full and their teams couldn't play any games. Another one of Volant's rivals, Mercer College, went a different route and literally kidnapped Rube, stopping him at gunpoint as he was riding a buggy from Butler over to Volant and forcing him to play for Mercer in their upcoming game against Volant. Rube was totally fine with this, and it ended up being the only game Volant lost that season. One could only imagine what the other Volant players thought. Just when you might think fate was going to stop playing Mad Libs with Rube's life, he was arrested mid-game by the National Guard, which he had impulsively signed up for and then forgotten about months ago because he liked their uniforms. Now, as an official National Guard member, Rube was considered AWOL, and spent the remainder of the season in military prison at the local National Guard base. Until a stove there was destroyed by someone throwing a handful of ammunition cartridges at it. The official story is that the National Guard couldn't find anyone on the base who could throw with that much precision and strength. But either way, Rube Waddell was discharged from the Guard soon after. All the better for him, because he could return to playing baseball. After his brief involvement with the boys in blue, does the National Guard wear blue? I don't know. Rube Waddell quickly got back to baseball. His period with Volant College, which went out of business a few years later, presumably because it was flagrantly corrupt, had revived his baseball career, and he spent stints over the next year or so playing for local teams in the Pittsburgh metro area. First Evans City, then Homestead Athletic Club, where his record attracted attention from newspapers across Pennsylvania. Rube had unlocked a real, honest interest in baseball by then, and he even became able to stay focused on the game even when a fire engine screamed past the stadium. He was still not immune to distraction, though. Fans of other teams learned that they could distract him by holding up puppies, which he would run up into the stands to play with, or by waving around shiny objects, which sent him into a sort of trance. Even with these pretty big handicaps, Rube easily struck out the opposing teams with mechanical regularity, and, to nobody's surprise, by the end of his season with Homestead Athletic Club, Major League scouts began showing up at Homestead games to evaluate Rube's playing. Right as the Major League season was finishing up, the Louisville Colonels, whose team name actually predates KFC, signed him and got him a train ticket down to Washington, D.C., where the team was playing a series. Rube had to start immediately. The Colonels had had several injuries on the team, putting a lot of their best players out of commission late in the regular season, which explained why they were bringing on a high-profile new player on such short notice. Rube's addition didn't really turn the Colonel's fortunes around that year, but he showed that he could hold his own against some of the best teams at the time, like the Baltimore Orioles, and sent a hometown crowd in Louisville against the Pittsburgh Pirates, who he still held a grudge against, into peals of laughter by miming the Pirates' pitcher's warm-up moves, making cow and pig noises, and once again, doing handsprings and cartwheels across the field. People loved this quirky new pitcher, who in addition to being talented, saw sports as a venue for being wacky. Rube Waddell may have been popular among Louisvillians, but he wasn't popular among his teammates, who were more than a little bit annoyed at this manic pixie dream guy who had just shown up in their midst. The Colonels were still having a rough season, suffering a series of embarrassing losses, and a lot of the team's players were irritated by Rube's constant cheerfulness in the face of losing. To them, Rube seemed to be more focused on being a class clown than being a good player. Fred Clark, the Colonel's manager, mistook Rube's true nature for just a bit of rookie player immaturity, and traded him to the Detroit Tigers, which were considered a lesser team at the time. If the Tigers were a bottom-tier team when they signed Rube, they weren't anymore as soon as they had him, overturning longtime rivals left and right. They faced the Colonels just the next season, and while at this point the Colonels had signed Honus Wagner, a fellow Western Pennsylvania resident, who is sometimes to this day considered the best baseball player of all time, Rube took the Tigers to within inches of winning. Around then, Rube started to do his signature stunt, the thing that baseball geeks remember him for first and foremost. This requires a little bit of knowledge of the Byzantine rules of baseball. So, Rube Waddell was a pitcher. The pitcher throws to the batter, who is on the other team. You can skip to this time if you already know all this. The pitcher throws to the batter, who is on the other team. The pitcher is trying to throw the ball so quickly or unpredictably that the batter can't hit it. If the batter does hit it, all the other players on the pitcher's team who are in the outfield behind the pitcher try to catch it, and other stuff happens depending on whether or not someone can catch it in time. If nobody catches it in time, the batter's team scores a run, which is good for them. But if the batter doesn't hit the ball, that's a strike, and the batter gets three strikes, and they're out. You know that part, at least. And then another batter comes out and gets three chances to hit, and if they get struck out too, a third batter gets a chance, and once they've gone through three batters, the team switch sides. When Rube was pitching, and his teammates were behind him in the outfield, waiting to catch the ball if the batter hit it, he would sometimes tell all his teammates to leave the field, leaving nobody to catch the ball, because he was that confident nobody would need to, since he'd be able to strike out all three of the rival team's batters. He was that sure no batter could ever hit his pitch. Rube only did this in exhibition games, games that didn't have real stakes for his team's stats, because in regular games it's against the rules to have fewer than 9 players on the field at once. He would sometimes skirt this rule by having his teammates crowd around him as he pitched, unable to catch a ball if the batter hit it. One of the greatest power moves in any sport ever, and a sign that Rube Waddell was more than just weird. He was a truly great player. The Tigers' fortunes fell over the next few seasons, and Rube was left in a situation he should have, by this point, been getting used to, being the only legitimately good player on a mediocre team. Headlines covering Tigers games bore phrases like, "How not to play ball," while cartoons portrayed Rube literally towering over the other Tigers players. One great player can't really carry a team, especially when he asks all of his teammates to walk off the field. And while Rube had gotten over his issues with fire engines, puppies, and shiny objects by this point, he had a new and growing impediment to his performance. Alcohol. He'd begun drinking around the time he was dropped from the Iron and Oil League, and he'd never really kicked the habit, sometimes appearing on the field drunk, but throwing as straight as ever. The papers treated this as just another one of his eccentricities. He's not an alcoholic. He's Rube frickin' Waddell. Let him cook! But it really was impacting the Tigers' performance, and the team's owner, Frank Van Derbeck, began to get mad. There was already some bad blood between Derbeck and Rube Waddell, after Derbeck had fined him for skipping a game to coach a bunch of kids in a sandlot game. Rube never understood why he was fined, saying, "He was a baseball player, right? So how could you fine a ball player for playing ball?" As the Tigers' performance slipped, Rube's attendance at his own games once again became more and more sporadic. At his last game as a signed Tigers player, Rube appeared not as a player, but as a spectator, crunching down several bags of peanuts in the stands and trying to engage others in conversation about how much Derbeck just didn't understand baseball. After that, Rube skipped the country. He was in Detroit, after all, where you can go south into Canada and north into the U.S. because of the bend in the river the city is situated on. If you're born and raised in South Detroit, you're a Canuck. Still on the lam from the Tigers, he quickly joined a small-town baseball team in Chatham, Ontario, where he once again charmed audiences and brought stardom to a much-maligned team. He also began carrying a shillelagh, which is like a gnarled club that leprechauns carry, for self-defense, until he gave it to a local lawyer as payment for getting him out of an unspecified, rough legal situation. Rube Waddell's shillelagh is now visible in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Rube eventually returned home to Pennsylvania and spent the next few years bouncing from team to team, some big and some small. He was a real enigma for anyone managing a baseball team. Here's a player who can pitch better than anyone you've ever seen, but there's a catch, no pun intended. He's totally uncontrollable, gets drunk and feuds with his teammates, and can't be depended on to show up when you have a game. He followed a pattern repeating over and over, often multiple times a season. He would be signed by an underdog team, revive their flagging fortunes, become a beloved local star, get in some sort of dispute with the manager or teammates, and gradually become less and less dependable, dragging the team down with him until he was traded somewhere else. First, he went back near home to the Homestead Athletic Club in Pittsburgh, then to a minor league team in Columbus, Ohio, then Grand Rapids, Michigan, then all the way back to the Louisville Colonels. During his stint in Grand Rapids, he pioneered the ice bath as a post-game victory celebration, as well as going back to wearing his old red fireman suit under his jersey, but this time as a promotional gimmick, because Rube's eccentricities were well known in the press by this point. At one point, while he played in Grand Rapids, though, he abruptly skipped off to Northern Michigan and played one game with a small-town baseball team there, under a false name and identity as a Norwegian immigrant, so his Grand Rapids boss wouldn't hear about it. He was back in Grand Rapids the next day, with no explanation for his Norsky escapade. After his second period with the Louisville Colonels, where Fred Clark was still the manager and didn't like Rube anymore the second time around, he got transferred, along with several other star players from the Colonels, including Honus Wagner, to none other than the Pittsburgh Pirates, the first major league team that had ever shown interest in him, and the first major league team he'd ever beat. Not long after arriving, Rube got married to a woman named Florence Dunning he'd met while playing in Ohio. Now, if you're thinking, how the hell does a guy like this get married? Here's a clue. observed by a colonel's teammate who was invited to his wedding. During Rube and Florence's wedding reception, they had a Charlotte Russe, a little cake with crumbly pastry surrounding whipped cream and strawberries, for dessert. It came in a paper wrap, and Florence, not Rube, Florence, ate it paper and all. Rube asked if she liked it, and she said, "The crust was delicious." They were perfect for each other. If there's hope for Rube, there's hope for us all. Back home in Pittsburgh, Rube painted the town. Not literally, although I wouldn't put it past him. He was known for going to theaters and, during the intermission, announcing in a booming voice, "Who's the best ball player in the world?" To which the audience, recognizing him, would chorus back, "You are!" He began playing football, a sport that was only growing in popularity at the time, with some of his Pirates teammates during the off-season, at the farmhouse outside Pittsburgh, where he now lived with Florence. Now, in the shakeup that had resulted in many of the Colonel's players moving to Pittsburgh, Fred Clark had also moved to Pittsburgh, and he was now managing the Pirates. Once again, he had little tolerance for Rube's rubalicious actions. What was it this time? Well, he'd been caught playing marbles with some kids under the stands right as one of his games was starting. And, hinting at a later career decision, Rube began acting. Yes, Rube Waddell, acting. In the evenings, often right after games, he could regularly be found at Pittsburgh's Union Scout Theater Company, appearing in plays despite his inability to remember his lines and using his experience from being Vallant College's drum major, remember that fever dream, to conduct the theater's orchestra. Clark was already leaning towards firing Rube, no matter how good he was, and he finally did so after some fans asked Rube how to throw a curveball, and having no baseball handy, Rube demonstrated with a brick, injuring his arm. Rube was out of a job. Also, can we just appreciate how this guy's signature baseball move was a curveball? As in, the literal type of baseball pitch? That's what the Coen brothers' biopic of his life would be called. Curveball. Rube wandered out into rural Pennsylvania, playing for a little while in Punxsutawney, the Groundhog Day town, which is a real place. About then, another old enemy of Rube's came back into his life, this one having changed his mind a bit more when he heard about how great a player Rube turned out to be. Connie Mack! He-him, real name Cornelius McGillicuddy, the previous manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, who now headed up the Milwaukee Brewers. No matter what Rube had allegedly said to Mack all those years ago, Mack was over it now, and he wanted Rube to play for the Brewers. Convincing Rube to leave Punxsutawney was easy. All Mack had to say was that Milwaukee was the nation's beer capital at the time, and that he would pay off all the debts that Rube had somehow accrued at basically every business in Punxsutawney. Convincing the townsfolk to let him go would be the harder part, Mack thought. These people aren't going to let their world-class baseball star who has somehow shown up in their little town leave without a fight, right? Well, yeah, that's what they thought. When Mack and Rube arrived at the train station in Punxsutawney, with their train to Milwaukee leaving in 5 minutes, thanks to Rube's general lack of understanding of time, they found a crowd of prominent Punxsutawneyites there, including the sheriff and the manager of the local baseball team. Uh-oh, Mack thought. They aren't gonna let Rube leave, right? Well, no. Here are the words spoken by the manager of the Punxsutawney team to Connie Mack as he and Rube stepped on the train. "Mr. Mack, my friends and myself have come down here to thank you. Waddell is a great pitcher, but we feel that Punxsutawney would be better off without him." Rube's time in Milwaukee was uneventful, by Rube's standards, with one exception. That time, he actually helped put out a fire. Connie Mack, he him, understood Rube Waddell a lot better than any other team manager had, and would give Rube time off to go fishing every now and then, which Rube loved, to minimize the chances of Rube doing everything else that got him kicked off teams. During Rube's fishing expeditions, he would usually go out to little lakeside towns outside of Milwaukee, and on one such outing to Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, which, if nothing else, proves that Rube had a soft spot for town names as entertaining as he was, he happened to witness a house on fire. Whether or not there were firefighters on site has not been recorded. Whether Rube got naked has not been recorded either, though I think it would be commented on if it had happened, so I'm gonna say he didn't. Either way, to gasps from the crowd gathered at the scene, some of whom recognized him as the Brewers' new star pitcher, Rube dove into the burning house to retrieve a crying boy's red wagon, which had been left inside. He emerged carrying the wagon and presented it to the little boy. That's not volunteer firefighting, that's vigilante firefighting. Who needs a real fire department when you can have one very determined alcoholic baseball player? In doing this, Rube got burns on his fingers that damaged his nerves, making him unable to feel pain on his hands for a few months. Mac saw this as an asset, and so did Rube. He was at the top of his game pitching, and the Milwaukee Brewers rose and rose in the rankings. Seeing Rube's success in Milwaukee and remarkable lack of rubiness, Fred Clark decided to give the big guy a third chance, proving that maybe Rube isn't the only one here who has poor judgment and can't learn. So Rube moved back to Pittsburgh once again. Having split on acrimonious terms the last time they saw each other, Clark wasn't sure how Rube would react to seeing them again. When they met again in Pittsburgh, the first thing Rube did was pull out a Bowie knife. Clark nearly had a heart attack. But then Rube proceeded to cut off the button from his own pants and hand it to Clark, saying he'd noticed Clark was missing a button on his shirt, and he wondered if Clark wanted one of his instead. Aww. Also, it's possible that he just didn't recognize Clark. Rube's first partial season, back with the Pirates, after playing with the Brewers, was a huge success, taking them to the top of the American League. But by the time the next season began, Rube had overstayed his welcome yet again, and after several disappointing showings, Clark fired him yet again, saying, "Get the hell off my ball team!" Everybody, get the hell off my ball team! Get the hell off my lawn! I've had it to here with your clowning acts. I strongly care if you ever come back, go and root through the garbage. Go hang your head down in shame, 'cause it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. And it was. Rube had his 3 strikes, and he never came back to the Pittsburgh Pirates. You'd think that by now Major League Baseball would have learned their lesson. Don't give Rube Waddell a job for too long. But he was still unquestionably the best pitcher in the game, and soon he was back on a high-profile team, this time the team that would later become the Chicago Cubs, which at the time were semi-officially called the Chicago Orphans, because their manager and star player, Adrian Cap Anson, had retired, leaving the team adrift, like an orphan. Go, orphans, go, I guess. While playing with the Orphans, repeating the familiar first half of the Rube Waddell Hero's Journey arc of saving a beleaguered team and becoming the talk of the town, Rube began hobnobbing with actors in Chicago high society. Acting may have been his third passion in life behind baseball and firefighting, and soon he was beginning to be invited backstage in many of Chicago's vaudeville theaters. At one point, he discharged an arsenal of over 40 guns, all loaded with blanks, backstage in a theater, right as a weepy romantic scene was being acted on stage. The lead actor quickly ad-libbed something about the sheriff being after them, and Rube was chased out of the theater. Another time, when the circus came to town, Rube thought it would be a good idea to interrupt a lion tamer routine by going up and taunting the lion. He walked away with a gash on his right arm, but fortunately, Rube Waddell was a lefty. The other half of Rube's ever-familiar hero's journey came along soon enough. With the orphans dropping in the rankings, and Rube missing games, fishing, drinking, and fruitlessly trying to find and put out fires. Toward the end of the season, he disappeared entirely, occasionally popping up playing on a minor league team in a few small towns around the Midwest. At the end of the season, once again, Rube moved on to another team, this time to do a brief off-season tour of California, which at this point was a long way from becoming the most populated state. There were no major league teams out there, and Rube's exhibition run in Los Angeles was pretty much just for East Coast baseball promoters to judge whether there was even a big enough market for major league teams in California. Playing for the Los Angeles Lulus against the Oakland Mudhens, which really were the names of those teams, Rube got in a little more vigilante firefighting, this time right in the stadium. An old mattress had been hoisted up behind the scoreboard to serve as a backstop, which is exactly how janky the state of pro sports on the West Coast was at this point. A fan's carelessly tossed cigarette ignited it, and the fans stampeded out of the stands, fearing the wooden structure would catch on fire. But Rube Waddell was there to avert such a catastrophe, grabbing the burning mattress with his bare hands and tossing it out into the middle of the field, where it could burn harmlessly. Having burned his hands again, his pitching probably got even better. Back when I did this episode on the radio at my college, one of my friends commented that it was just a rotating cast of characters, and it kinda is. 'Cause guess who came back into Rube's life next? Connie Mack. He him. And he came back in a big way. Mack managed the Philadelphia Athletics now, who coincidentally would later play in Oakland, and he was seen as the proverbial tamer of Rube Waddell, one of the only baseball managers who understood Rube enough to get good play out of him for multiple seasons. Hearing that Rube was out in California and enjoying it, though, Connie Mack hired officers from the Pinkerton Detective Agency, a for-hire police force often otherwise used by business leaders to break up strikes in those days, to kidnap Rube and bring him back east. This wasn't Punxsutawney. He didn't want to leave without a fight, but by the time Rube was back in Pennsylvania in handcuffs, he was glad to see Connie Mack again. Rube was sad to see California in the proverbial rearview mirror, but at least Connie Mack was managing him again, and he made a close friend on the Philadelphia A's, a fellow named Aussie Schreckengost, who I will give you three guesses as to what fans nicknamed him. 3, 2, 1, Shrek. Shrek, the lovable cartoon green ogre, had yet to be invented at this point, so Aussie Schreckengost was arguably the original Shrek. Nevertheless, I will not be calling him Shrek. I am a man of culture and high breeding, and I am not going to have any mention of Shrek on my YouTube channel. I will call him by his full name, Aussie Schreckengost, and his full name, Aussie Schreckengost, only. The peak of Rube's commercial success came during his time with the Philadelphia A's, who he stayed with for a pretty long time, by his standards. He owned Philadelphia. He was associated with the city itself, the way he had never been associated with the places he played before. A common joke in the early 1900s was that Philadelphia has two must-see things, the Liberty Bell and Rube Waddell, and they're both a little bit cracked. People were funny in the 1900s. When the A's traveled, Rube would share hotel rooms with Aussie Schreckengost, where he annoyed Aussie Shrek and Gost nearly every night by eating animal crackers in bed. Aussie Shrek and Gost wrote to Connie Mack saying, quote, "While I did not mind Rube bringing mockingbirds and a reptile or two into our sleeping arrangements," end quote, he wanted a clause added to Rube's contract specifically banning him from eating animal crackers in bed. It's not clear if Aussie Shrek and Gost got his wish. Going into his second season with the A's, Rube disappeared again when the team went to Florida for spring training. Now, you're probably thinking, oh, Florida, of course! How did it take us so long for Rube Waddell and Florida, the Rube Waddell of states, to meet? But like California, Florida in those days was seen as incredibly remote, sparsely populated, and nearly uninhabitable. It's only one of those three today. Teammates feared Rube had been eaten by an alligator or something. But they couldn't have been more wrong. After weeks of searching, he was discovered wrestling alligators in a traveling circus. His friend Aussie Shrek and Gost asked Rube if he wanted to participate in the A's spring training. Rube said he didn't need more training, and disappeared for a few more weeks, until he resurfaced this time as the drum major for a marching band. But Connie Mack, he him, was patient, and Rube stayed with the A's for the next season. It started rough, but Rube's and the team's performance improved, until Rube divorced Florence, got married again, and then, just a few months after getting remarried, was arrested on the orders of his now wife for sleeping in a bar. He was released after spending the night in jail, but his performance on the field fell off after that, and once the season was over, Rube decided to take his career in a decidedly different direction. He began acting for real this time. The play Rube acted in, The Stain of Guilt, was an awfully generic Victorian melodrama. Rube was a supporting actor, playing the main character's kind-hearted brother, who, at the climax of the play, had to appear in the nick of time and punch the villain. As you can probably guess, Rube could not get that he was actually not supposed to punch the villain and merely look like he's punching him. In several performances, he punched so hard he propelled the poor guy backwards straight into the orchestra pit. Rube also could never remember his lines, but surprisingly, he proved not too bad at ad-libbing, and sometimes took the plot in completely different directions than what was written. The Stain of Guilt turned into a sort of improv show, with a new story every night. The only commonality between each performance was that Rube punched the same poor actor into the orchestra pit. The show got rave reviews, and ended up touring the eastern United States to packed theaters. There was nothing else like it at the time. Even Rube himself was surprised by his success as an actor, and used his newfound stage stardom to negotiate a bigger paycheck as a baseball player. The next baseball season, 1904, was a decent year for Rube and the Philadelphia Athletics, though nothing very Ruby happened. The biggest metaphorical curveball Rube threw was a minor scandal created when Rube was photographed fishing with local black farmers during spring training in South Carolina, and Philly baseball fans were terribly offended to learn that Rube was not racist. Spending the next winter at his in-laws' house in Lynn, Massachusetts, in his marriage that would soon collapse, Rube saved people from a third fire. Details are a little bit murky here. Sources disagree on whether it was his in-laws' house, a random house nearby, or a department store that had the fire. I think it was a house. I think the department store was a fourth fire Rube was involved in putting out less than a year later while in D.C. for a game. Either way, Rube happened to yet again be in or near a house on fire, and sources are clear on what he did. He noticed that an oil stove was sitting right in the middle of the flames, and it was on the verge of exploding, which could have been lethal to everyone in the building. So once again, Rube grabbed the stove with his bare hands. It is surprising that this man, being a professional baseball player, seems to have never heard of gloves, and tossed it out into a snowbank where it fizzled out harmlessly. This is a fascinating story because you didn't often see Rube being clever like that. Most of the things he achieved by being brawny, dumb, and always willing to go along with the ride. To the extent that he was clever like a medieval jester, like a wise fool, trickster sort of figure. There aren't a lot of Rube anecdotes where he notices something others don't and acts on it, and I think it's not a coincidence that when he did, it had to do with his biggest obsession off the field. Firefighting. He didn't just love firefighting, he had some knowledge of fire safety. It seems like he liked learning about firefighting, which should draw you in the direction of a particular conclusion about Rube, if you haven't already made that conclusion. Anyway, Rube's hands were burned once again, which probably meant even better pitching than usual. 1905 was the A's best year yet. They beat all their regional rivals and were expected to be strong contenders for the World Series. But here is where we arrive at what the Society for American Baseball Research, who have examined Rube's career under their strongest baseball microscopes, referred to as the strangest month in the strange career of Rube Waddell. So, Rube Waddell was out of commission for the 1905 World Series, which the A's could have won if he was in the game. The reason he was out of commission is still debated to this day, but the official one given by the team is the most Rube reason ever. He got injured in a fight he started over his teammate's right to wear a straw hat. This was sort of a running joke on the team. There was like a rule that you couldn't wear straw hats after Labor Day in 19th century America. We're in the 20th century, but around then, straw hats were common summer wear, and you couldn't wear them after Labor Day, supposedly. And so members of the Philadelphia Athletics would destroy each other's straw hats if they saw their teammates wearing them. It was sort of just a fun bonding ritual, but as they were getting on a train back to Philadelphia, after a series in Boston, Rube ambushed an unsuspecting teammate, Andy Coakley, wearing a straw hat on the platform. Coakley's fight-or-flight response kicked in, since Rube was a huge guy, and he fought back. So Rube fought back, resulting in a brawl of several players versus Rube. When the dust settled, Rube had hurt his pitching arm. But according to the Society for American Baseball Research, this might not be the real story. They discovered newspaper articles putting down Rube's unexpectedly poor performance in a few games leading up to the World Series to a sore arm. Except that those stories predate the apparent straw hat fight by a few days. Rumors were already circulating that if Rube played in the World Series, rival team supporters would try to exploit his eccentricities to get him out of the game. Way back in rural Pennsylvania when he was young, sometimes rival teams would call fake fires in order to get fire engines passing by the stadium. The Philadelphia Sporting News claimed that the manager of the New York Giants, who back then were a baseball team, not a football team, was planning to take Rube on a long, all-expenses-paid fishing trip during the World Series. None of his teammates claim to have witnessed the straw hat fight, and there is no question that Rube Waddell would have been easy to bribe. And in the aftermath of the infamous Black Sox scandal, several years later in 1919, when New York gambling tycoons paid the Chicago White Sox to throw the results of the World Series, many people claimed that it wasn't the first time the World Series had been fixed, just the first time anyone had been caught for it. If it had been fixed before, it's a good chance that a scheme to fix the World Series would have involved baseball's most talented pitcher, and perhaps most childlike and susceptible to influence. Rube's career declined after that, which could be more evidence of a fix, because he was definitely still talented. Until the Straw Hat incident, Rube's 1905 season had been one of the greatest seasons any pitcher had ever or has ever had. He set records that still stand today, which is extremely rare in any sport for records that old to still stand. But he didn't have a lot of baseball-related achievements after this. He still led the league in strikeouts for the fifth consecutive year, but Connie Mack gave him a pay cut. In the A's 1906 season, they slid, Rube and his teammates alike. Rube's life was racked by domestic trouble. He was now on his third marriage, and it too was falling apart like his two previous ones, due to Rube's increasing drinking and his... Rube. He told reporters scandalous stories about his teammates drinking and gambling, all while he claimed he himself was clean as a whistle, but that was a far cry from his previous antics, and his teammates laughed with him. Alan Levy writes that a certain melancholia began to take over from the intensity he previously displayed. In 1907, the A's went to a tiny town in Texas for spring training, where the team's club secretary recommended the team go hunting in their spare time, saying he would personally prepare any game the team brought in. Rube immediately went out and shot someone's mule. The secretary reneged on his promise. A few days later, the team went to Dallas to play some exhibition games. Unfortunately, this happened to be exactly when the Dallas Fire Department was carrying out training drills. When Rube deserted the team, Connie Mack figured he knew exactly where he'd gotten off to, but he was still surprised, a few days later, to see Rube pull up to practice in head-to-toe, authentic firefighting regalia, driving a hook-and-ladder truck with the full approval of the Dallas Fire Department. Mack wisely let him wear his firefighting suit under his baseball uniform, just like in the old days. 1907 was the season where the other shoe dropped at long last. Rube had had a good run with the A's, but now it was clear that no matter what team he was on, he would eventually start missing games, drinking, and fishing. When he was on the field, he didn't do nearly as well as he used to. Rube's worst was still most pitchers' best. He still led the league in strikeouts. But his teammates were sick of him, getting away with missing games and showing up drunk. Fans of rival teams would chant, "Rube, Rube, you've been drinking. You can't see the plate." For the 1908 season, Connie Mack grudgingly sold Rube to the St. Louis Browns. Rube played with the Browns for 3 years, never reaching the heights of his glory days. During the offseason, he'd be sent to hunt and fish for the team, which kept both Rube and his teammates happy and out of trouble. During one of his duck hunting expeditions, Rube saved a boater from drowning. Newspapers commented on how he wasn't quite so weird anymore, barely hiding their disappointment. Eventually, Rube was dropped from the major leagues and had to go back into the minor leagues, which used to be a pretty common fate for former star baseball players. They didn't get paid much, even when they were pro players for a major league team and couldn't afford to retire as soon as they were past their prime. Rube was no exception. He joined the Minneapolis Millers, where he did pretty well. He got married for a fourth time while with the Millers, although this one lasted less than a year. Even when Rube wasn't on the field, he was being useful for the Millers. Once, when Minneapolis was playing a series against their arch-rival Toledo, Rube took a leave of absence to go fishing, on which he invited Toledo's star pitcher, Eric Yingling. The Millers' office would later be billed for Rube's purchase of several fish during the time that he was supposedly fishing with Yingling, so nobody's quite sure what Rube and Yingling were really doing, but it kept Yingling out of the big series of games, and Minneapolis won. Then came Rube's final act. The baseball records were all in the past by the time Rube was beginning his second season with the Millers. Though only 35, Rube had visibly aged since he left Philadelphia 4 long years ago. He was perpetually drunk and claimed to have forgotten how many women he had married over the years. But he had one great achievement left in him. The Millers did their spring training in Hickman, Kentucky, a sleepy little town along the Mississippi River. On March 28, 1912, the mighty Mississippi burst its banks. Rube immediately sprung into action, putting his burly frame to use, piling sandbags on the levees by the river. He worked for 4 straight days. The water kept rising, though, faster than Rube could pile sandbags along the banks, and on April 1st, 1912, the levees burst, and an 8-foot wave of water washed into Hickman. The team was safe and relocated to nearby Owensboro, but Rube couldn't help feeling that he had let the town of Hickman down. A rare moment of empathy for him. And the next winter, he got another chance. Rube had been spending the whole off-season in Kentucky rather than in icy Minnesota by this point, and in February 1913, an even bigger flood threatened Hickman. Rube sandbagged for that one too, and this time, Hickman was spared, leading to Rube being named the Honorary Fire Chief of Hickman, which I'm sure was an honor of a lifetime for him. Better than the Baseball Hall of Fame. In fact, a few weeks after the flood, he got involved in yet another act of vigilante firefighting. This one, not that heroic. While practicing with the Millers, he heard a siren, and as the fire chief of Hickman, clearly he had to respond. He stripped off his baseball jersey, no fireman's gear under it then, nor anything else, and in his birthday suit, just like old times, he ran down the street and, now this he'd never done before, hopped onto a pony, rode it bareback and bare-assed through Hickman looking for the fire, and finally, when he came upon the house on fire, proceeded to grab an axe from the dumbfounded firefighters and chop off the house's roof. Turns out the fire was entirely contained inside the chimney. Later that week, a humbled Rube, this time fully clothed, rebuilt the house for its pissed-off owners. And then, a few weeks on, the floods came back. Rube was back on the sandbagging line, this time mostly accompanied by black workers, who sang spirituals as they worked. Rube sang along, loud and off-key. Once again, the town was dry, but this proved to be Rube's final act of heroism. After the first flood, standing up his big alcoholic body in icy water for days, Rube had ended up spending a week bedridden with pneumonia. Now it came back in full force. By a month later, Rube claimed that he was strong enough to rejoin the Millers, but the team's manager doubted that and reassigned him to an even more minor league team, also based in Minneapolis. Rube got weaker and weaker over the course of the season. Injuries on the field compounded, and by July, he had another attack of pleurisy, a precursor to pneumonia. Rube went missing in Minnesota, and finally resurfaced back in St. Louis in November, picked up by police as a vagrant, and was diagnosed with tuberculosis. Having nowhere to go, he moved in with his sister Margaret in Burney, Texas, near San Antonio. He had lost 54 pounds. In March of 1914, he checked into a tuberculosis sanitarium in San Antonio, where he wrote a letter to young baseball players urging them not to become alcoholics like him. Exactly 2 years after the first flood in Hickman, the most outrageous man to ever play ball died on April Fool's Day, 1914. He was 37. What was the deal with him? What could have been wrong with the great Rube Waddell? Being autistic myself, I see a lot of myself in him. Rube was a little more detached from reality than I ever was, but not by much, and his mercurial temper, huge talent at one particular thing, and fascinations with fishing and especially fire engines really make it clear, to me at least, that he was autistic. His firefighting mania and the way he would sacrifice everything else for the prospect of running after a fire engine really reminds me of how I am with trains, because, you know, I'm just that much of an autistic stereotype. If Rube Waddell was autistic, is it okay to laugh at him? I would say yes, because we're laughing with him. He may have died young, but for a time he got to pursue his dreams in a way few of us ever do. It's hard enough to be that successful when you're not also that weird, even today, when people know what autism is, and eccentric celebrities are a whole category. There will never be another Rube Waddell, and maybe that's a good thing. After all, nobody knew what autism was when Rube was alive, and the difference between me and someone as erratic as Rube Waddell probably comes down to parenting alone. But the world is a richer place for having Rube Waddell in it. And not just the world of baseball, but so many other worlds as well, from acting to firefighting. Something you can't really say of a lot of sports stars. He did it all. A true main character, in the words of friend of this channel, Annie Ruerta, of Depths of Wikipedia, which is who I first learned about Waddell from. Except that Rube Waddell was wonderfully, magnificently real.
Love.